From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The clock is ticking on the FBI's investigation of sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. It could end as soon as today. And Republicans are reacting to President Trump's mocking of Kavanaugh's accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, at a rally last night.
Trump critic Jeff Flake, who'd said he'd vote for Kavanaugh before calling for that FBI investigation, called the remarks from the president last night appalling, but told CNN Today they wouldn't affect his vote. Maine Senator Susan Collins, undecided and a Trump critic, said this today.
The president's comments were just plain wrong.
And at the Atlantic Festival this morning, Trump and Kavanaugh supporter South Carolina's Lindsey Graham said this.
So President Trump went through a factual rendition that I didn't particularly like, and I would tell him, knock it off. You're not helping.
Knock it off. Well, in the midst of this latest uptick in the Kavanaugh story, a report from the New York Times alleging that President Trump is not the self-made billionaire he claims to be. His money came from inheritance, fraud, and tax dodging. Let's take this all up with our weekly strategist roundtable. On the Democratic side, Karine Jean-Pierre. Hi, Karine.
Hey, Robin.
And we also have the Republican strategist, John Brabender. John, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And John, I want to get right to it. The president and his son, and not just the president attacking Ford last night, but the president and his son, Don Jr., also repeating the words of conservative commentators like Rush Limbaugh, that this is actually a dangerous time for men. Don Trump Jr. said he's more worried for his sons than his daughters. Is this a new Republican strategy we're hearing? And if so, do you think it's a good one?
Well, let me attack this from a couple of different angles. Mm-hmm. First of all, I do think that the president got a little bit caught up in the moment of a rally. And I think we got to be careful. I didn't take that he was mocking Professor Ford. I took that he was questioning some of the inconsistencies in her stories.
Oh,
which the tone of his voice.
Which a number of people did. Let me think. Second of all, there are elections coming up. And one of the things that we have found since last Thursday is what particularly some of the things the Senate Democrats did on the Judicial Committee has actually engaged and rallied and brought a lot of Republicans home. We know that the Democrats were engaged and together since the day Donald Trump got elected, but Republicans were soft going into the 2018 election. Mm-hmm. And frankly, what a lot of sitting on the side Republicans saw actually moved them to become much more engaged for this 20 election.
Like what? I'm curious.
Well, look, let's just take the Quinnipiac poll that came out that 49% of Americans, not Democrats, Republicans, but both, said that they thought that Kavanaugh was the victim of a political attack. We saw that, for example, we learned at that hearing almost a week ago that the Democrats somehow forgot to tell Professor Ford that this could have been done in closed doors out in California because we know they wanted the spectacle of the day and having 25 million people tune in like they did. Mm-hmm. We found out that that she wanted this kept confidential, yet somehow, some way that they had a letter that leaked out and only could have been leaked from them. And so I think, number one, a lot of people see that the Democrats are using her as a pawn. Second of all, we're now getting into what I guess you would call silly season, when yesterday all over the news was the breaking IceGate scandal that, you know, Kavanaugh actually threw a piece of ice at somebody back in his college days. And this was actually seen as important news. And
it wasn't a piece of ice. It was a glass filled with
glass
ice.
Of,
and it
good.
Was a police call. Police were called.
Karine,
yeah. Somebody got arrested.
Karine, I want to bring you into this conversation because Alice Stewart, a Republican strategist who we have on regularly, mm-hmm. put out a tweet today that I thought was instructive and mirrors sort of what John is saying here, that dumpster diving into Kavanaugh's background will backfire on Democrats. It's not about Ford and it's not about seeking the truth. It's about trashing his character. I mean, what about that? Do you think that will resonate with Republicans come the midterms?
John says
John's
it is.
Saying?
Yeah.
Well, here's where we are. Kavanaugh is the least popular Supreme Court nominee in history. And we knew that before Dr. Ford came out more than 2 weeks ago, and that majority of Americans did not want him to serve on the Supreme Court. So you have a historically unpopular president nominating a historically unpopular Supreme Court nominee being pushed by a hugely unpopular Congress. So I don't see the political upside for voting for Kavanaugh. And sure, some of the Republicans Republicans, I'm not going to take that away from John, sure have come home, but it's a small and shrinking base. Women, I do believe that women will decide this election, and young people. And I think that this nomination is going to be a political disaster for Republicans when it comes to women and young people.
And John, you're feeling that you're seeing the polling on your side, but I just want to ask you about something. You heard us all kind of like, oh, John, when you were talking about...
Yes, thank you for editorializing during my responses.
But I'm sure there was a chorus that we were echoing, on the other side of the dial, because you said the president was caught up in a rally. Let's listen to him speaking last night, mocking Ford's testimony.
How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know.
And John, here's Trump last Friday on Ford's testimony.
I thought her testimony was very compelling, and she looks like a very fine woman to me. Very fine woman.
Speak to that, John Brabender. Notion that is that a way a president should speak, A, and B, doesn't he know that people cut those two things together and hear them?
Well, look, if we're going to go back to is Donald Trump going to start talking like the expectation we have for a president? I think we need to go back to watching the campaign, and he never did that as a campaign. He hasn't done that in 2 years as president. So let's take that expectation right off the table, and all of us agree Donald Trump is never going to act like a traditional president. Second of all, I do think that Donald Trump spends a lot of time watching news, listening to news, probably a lot of NPR. And, what we are hearing out there is this constant voice from the Democrats trying to run this incredible negative attack against Kavanaugh. And I think that, when we talk about he's unpopular, my God, it's the same reason that it was the most unpopular Republican and Democrat nominee for president in history. We now live in this culture where it's attack, attack, attack all the time. And so I do think the president was frustrated. I think he felt that he was not attacking Professor Ford personally, but pointing out questions about her sort of story, because everybody wants to talk about Brett Kavanaugh, but nobody is talking about that there was a report generated by Ms. Mitchell that said that there were a lot of inconsistencies and added there were holes in her story. And it's we all now say, okay, we got to believe the woman. And I understand that from a history standpoint. But tell me, which women are we supposed to believe? In this case, the accuser, the prosecutor, or somebody like Dianne Feinstein, who obviously somebody is not telling the truth about leaking documents.
Can I just say this, Robin and Peter, is that there was Gorsuch, and I was in the fight to stop Gorsuch. And he got through. Kamala Harris, Senator Harris, did something that was pretty amazing on Thursday, I thought, which was she put forth Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. And they basically have had the same trajectory. They both went to Georgetown Prep. They have kind of the same career trajectory. And the one difference was there was sexual allegations against Kavanaugh. Gorsuch made it through. We fought, but he still made it through. So I feel like this notion of like we are dumpster diving and doing all of these things to stop Kavanaugh, we're not the ones that came forward.
There's no dumpster.
We're not the ones who did that.
That's not the perspective. What our true perspective is, okay, President Trump gets one pick. Now all of a sudden a second pick comes along. And let's face it,
Kennedy was going to retire. Yeah, was not a surprise.
But the goal right now is, can we delay until the vote count is possibly going to change after this election? And so,
but you guys have no moral ground to stand on. You have Mitch McConnell, who held a seat open for 14 months, who didn't give Merrick Garland a hearing. So to say that Democrats
are agreeing, then you're agreeing with me that they're saying that the rules have changed.
I'm saying that you guys are being hypocrites. That's what I'm saying.
The Democrats held on to a letter that they had for weeks and weeks and decided not to delay.
The second thing,
by the way, is Senator Coons said, let's just do a one-week investigation. And it's like, okay, we'll go along with that, because a Democrat senator on the judiciary case said do it. Now we all agree to that. And all I'm hearing from the Democrats is, oh, my gosh, Where did this crazy idea of it should only be a week? Well, came from one of you.
No, the difference. First of all, we saw a bipartisan. Corinne, I just want to jump in.
Okay. I think this is good. This is worth listening to. It's a good debate. We're running a little bit out of time. I appreciate your passion on both sides, but I want to talk about the New York Times investigation that came out yesterday. Of course, the president ran saying that he was a self-made billionaire. This investigation is claiming that his fortune came from his father pretty much exclusively. There were tax questions, possible fraud involving his father's money. Trump says it's an old story and boring. John, your thoughts. Did anything about this strike you?
Well, first of all, again, the surprise that the president uses puffery and hyperbole to describe himself is certainly nothing new, and we can expect that in the future. But here's the key. If our economy was in the tank, and people were making the argument, oh my gosh, we voted for this guy based upon we thought he was this great business success story. He's a failure in that business, and now he's ruining the economy. But the truth of the matter is the economy is incredible. I mean, we had the Federal Reserve saying it's firing on all cylinders. We see wages going up. We see unemployment in Hispanic and African-American communities lowest
in history.
Corinne,
you're going to hate this, but we're running out of time, and I don't know why it's relevant anymore. Thanks, Robin and Peter. Appreciate it.
Next time.
Yeah, John Brabender, the Republican strategist, Corinne Jean-Pierre, the Democratic strategist. That is all we have time for, but there is always a next time. So thank you both so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Didn't get to NAFTA, didn't get to the midterm.
The Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded today to three researchers whose work has harnessed the power of evolution. Two American scientists, Francis Arnold and George Smith, and one British scientist, Gregory Winter, are sharing the prize. Let's bring in Peter Doorhout. He's president of the American Chemical Society, and he's in Manhattan, Kansas, at Kansas State University. Peter, welcome. And first, the Royal Swedish Academy said the winning research applied the principles of Darwin in a test tube. Explain that.
So first of all, let me start out with my congratulations on behalf of the American Chemical Society to our three new Nobel laureates. Their tremendous breakthrough work in using chemistry to speed nature's own processes, and that's the reference to Darwin in a test tube. The laureates have used chemistry to accelerate the evolution of natural biological molecules that act as the critical machinery in the cells of living organisms.
And when we talk about Darwin, I think most people know this term natural selection. Is that in play here?
Well, being able to identify a process within a cell and to have that cell live through the next generation, continuing with that particular new process inside, is, in a sense, a natural selection. It'll survive if that new process improves the environment for that cell.
Why is this work significant?
Well, the ability to actually go into a simple cell, as we might think of it, and to do some fundamental chemistry is actually a lot more complicated than it sounds. Hmm. If we do chemistry in a beaker or a flask, we control a few of the variables, and we're able to really understand some of the outcomes that we ultimately observe. But in a living cell, like whether it's a bacterium or other living cell, it's a lot more complicated than just a simple beaker. And the real breakthroughs here are to be able to fine-tune that chemistry for a desired outcome, and ultimately to have that desired outcome occur in the next generation as opposed to waiting for a slow evolutionary process is really what's so spectacular here.
Now, we're reading that the research can be used to create things like more environmentally friendly chemicals, also pharmaceuticals. What are some of the real-world applications of all this?
Well, to be able to use the molecular machinery within a cell to make chemical compounds or proteins, that's what cells normally do anyway. But to be able to ask that cell to make a specific molecule is where the real creativity comes in. So imagine being able to provide a set of instructions to simple cells and have those cells repeat that process over and over again under very mild conditions, the chemistry suddenly becomes a lot more interesting because we can do some very complex chemical reactions, but do them in a very clean environment. And so really, the sky's the limit in terms of identifying molecular systems that we could imagine making in a chemistry environment like a beaker, but doing it in these organisms that enable us to take advantage of their natural processes. An example of a natural process created through an organism like yeast helps our bread rise in the generates ethanol or alcohol in the production of beer or wine.
Okay, let's talk about one of the winners, Frances Arnold of Caltech. Here's a recording of her getting called late in the night by someone from the committee to tell her that she had won, and she was remarkably calm.
You're away from home, so perhaps somewhat protected from the immediate onslaught that's going to happen today.
Well, I'm annoyed because I can't reach my son. They're sound asleep. So, yes, I'm protected, but I'm also annoyed. They never answer the phone when mom calls, you know.
All right, so Frances Arnold is only the fifth woman to win the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. Yesterday, we reported on Donna Strickland, a Canadian scientist, only the third woman to win the Nobel Prize in Physics for her work. What does all of that mean for science, and specifically for you in chemistry?
Well, I'll also point out that from what I can tell, this is the first time that women in physics and chemistry were recognized as laureates in the same year. But you're absolutely right. In the case of Professor Arnold, she's the fifth woman, and prior to that, it was Dorothy Hodgkins in 1964 that was recognized. And then you start going way back to Marie Curie in 1911, and then actually her daughter two decades later. So for us in the American Chemical Society, and for me personally, we're really advocating for broadening the participation in the chemical sciences specifically for folks from all different backgrounds and perspectives. And for us, recognizing the fact that Professor Arnold's work has risen to these levels is just fantastic.
Peter Dorhout is president of the American Chemical Society. He's there at Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Peter. And I wish everyone a great day.
Let's go to Colorado now for a story that many of us may have missed, but not if you're in Durango. That's because Lego sculptures have been popping up around Durango for the past couple of years. It's the work of Sam Bridgham, the Lego bomber. From Colorado Public Radio, Stephanie Wolf has this story.
Sam Bridgham asked me to meet him outside a coffee shop on Durango's main avenue and to wear a newspaper hat so he could identify me. I oblige, and I keep an eye out for an adult male in his 50s. Instead, I'm greeted by a blonde-haired 11-year-old. He tells me he's Sam, the Lego bomber, and takes me on a tour of, quote, his artwork.
I'm gonna have you go to the other side of the street up here on this next block. On the next block.
This Sam leads me to Lego sculptures around the town. Many are surprisingly discreet. You have to look up or down to see ones posted outside businesses. And I almost missed the Legos in the sign for the old main post office. They look like they're part of the stonework.
And the post office was cool with this? They've left it up?
Well, we put it up only a couple of days ago, but they're fine with it.
Our tour ends at an old junior high school that's been converted into space for yoga and art classes. There, we find a bright green centipede-like Lego creature crawling up a wall. I play along with Sam, but I finally call him out on his ruse and remind him I've seen pictures of the actual Sam Bridgham.
Well, they're taking photos of the older me.
Okay.
The older Sam, who was born in the 60s.
Can I meet the older Sam today?
Probably.
Okay.
Let me just grow up right now.
Okay.
One second.
Younger Sam disappears down a stairwell, and older Sam emerges from around the building.
Are you the older Sam?
Here I am.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, it was like Am I getting punked?
It's hard for me to get that young on a Sunday morning.
I learned Bridgen's impersonator is Nils Hansen, one of his assistants. He has a posse of them. But when Bridgen began Lego bombing 2 years ago, it was a solo endeavor.
I was just really frustrated. One night I'm lying in my bed, and I'm not ordinarily a praying man, but I gave it a try, got nothing, and just felt really irritated and decided to go vandalize something.
He happened to have hundreds of Legos lying around because he teaches Lego robotics through his own business called Alpine Educational Associates.
So I just took all these Legos and plastered it on a post trying to offend somebody. And what do you know, it was wildly misinterpreted as art. And here I am today.
Now many of his young Lego robotics students help him construct Lego bombs around the city, including places like a Starbucks sign or the window of the drive-thru pharmacy at a Walgreens. Hi.
This is Stephanie. She's from Colorado Public Radio.
Oh, hi there.
And I'm taking her on the tour.
Melissa Sullivan, who goes by Sully, is a senior pharmacy technician at Walgreens. Through the drive-thru intercom system, she tells me that she loves having the Lego sculpture there.
People ask about it sparks conversation, you know?
Bridgen has no idea how many Lego bombs are currently on view around town.
I'm sort of like a squirrel burying acorns. I leave them out and I often forget where they are, and then people tell me, oh yeah, I saw it over here.
Often the Lego bombs are taken down or moved.
These things have a lifespan, and sometimes it's just time for them to move on. They're not meant to be permanent.
His work certainly hasn't gone unnoticed. The Durango Herald has featured several articles about the town's resident Lego bomber. Bridgen's beginning to get more commissions, and in the spring, the city awarded him the first Durango Creates grant, $1,000 to Lego bomb a stretch of Main Avenue.
I'm a vandal with a budget now and a license, so I'm respectable society's worst enemy.
Colleen O'Brien is with the city of Durango. She says the fact that Bridgen had been Lego bombing without permission wasn't a red flag for the Public Art Commission. They liked how accessible his art is.
That helps you think of public spaces differently or even private spaces differently, and you can interact with it, and it just helps you pay a little bit closer attention.
Bridgen says he's been paying attention to how people respond to the Lego art, and he finds all kinds of deep meaning in it. But when you look at online comments, many people just call his Lego art fun. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Wolf.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Finally, some good news for Tesla. The electric car maker announced this week that it's hit a key production goal, 53,000 new Model 3 vehicles in the third quarter, and that's in line with what Tesla had told investors to expect. So, one promise kept. And a much-needed break after CEO Elon Musk's decision on Saturday to step down as chairman of Tesla and pay a fine for tweeting about his plan to take the company private. Lots to talk about, so let's bring in Claire Sebastian, business correspondent for CNN. She joins us now from New York. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Peter.
Tesla has struggled a lot to hit production goals over the years. We've talked about that here on the show. So how big of a deal is this news that it finally hit that mark?
Well, this is good news. You know, this is something that they really needed, frankly, in light of the recent questions over their credibility, particularly when it comes to communications with the market. And Elon Musk was very bullish about this over the weekend. He sent a message, we know, to staff, an email saying they needed to give it one more push, and they were very close to profitability. In terms of whether this means they will hit profitability, the analysts are a bit divided on that. Some say that it does show, you know, that this is a helpful, data point in the path to profitability. Others are worried about the challenges the company is facing when it comes to deliveries. We know that Musk in the past has talked about production hell. Now he's been talking about delivery logistics hell, he called it. And that did show up in the numbers a bit. They have a backlog of vehicles listed in transit, about 12,000 of them. That's less than the last quarter, but still a significant number. So I think that's why we see for the second day running now after that initial burst of enthusiasm on Monday, the stock price is down.
And just a note about profitability, Tesla has never had a profitable year.
That's absolutely true. And there are some still questions hanging over this year. Musk has promised repeatedly that in the third quarter and the fourth quarter, they will show a profit and they will be cash flow positive. As I said, he said to staff over the weekend that we're very close to that. And they've been cutting costs as well as increasing production. They've laid off 9% of their staff. We saw recently that they reduced some of the color options available for the Model 3 to cut costs as well. But cash flow is still a big issue for this company. They've got debt coming due, Peter, in November. And some next year. So getting to profitability, certainly from the analysts who cover this that I've been speaking to, is not something that they see as guaranteed.
You listed a lot of the reasons why the headlines about Tesla are often negative. So let's talk about this one earlier. The SEC settled with Elon Musk after he had this tweet that claimed he had the funding secured to take Tesla private. There are reports that Musk had threatened to resign at one point if the board decided to settle. So some last-minute change of heart, some drama. Do you think that Tesla and Musk are ready to put that behind them? I mean, do you think it'll do much long-term damage?
I think they were extremely ready to put that behind them. We saw how much of an overhang it had in the stock by the fact that it went up 17% on Monday, although, as I said, it has come back down again. It's not the only overhang they have. There's still a Department of Justice investigation that is hanging over them. That could potentially lead to criminal charges, although some experts I've spoken to have said that this settlement with the SEC potentially makes that less likely. Mm-hmm. I think the onus, Peter, is now really on the board. There have been questions throughout all of this about their independence. We know that there are several old friends of Musk there, not to mention, of course, his brother. They now have to pick a new chairman. People are looking at that and hoping that it will be an outsider, someone who can really keep Musk accountable.
The story will go on. Claire Sebastian, a business correspondent for CNN, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It was the part about the laughter that got me. That's what my male friend said to me. He said it was when Dr. Christine Blasey Ford said in her testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee that the worst part of her alleged assault was the laughter from her two alleged attackers. They were having a good time, she said, at my expense. Well, my friend said when he heard that, that was what threw him back over a half a century ago. He was 7, had gone to visit a cousin who'd moved to another state. There were 3 other boys there who immediately made the new kid their target. "We're going to castrate you," they said, and started chasing him. He wasn't even sure what that meant, but he ran. They tackled him, pinned him down. He said just like Blasey Ford said she was held down, a horrible feeling. But then his tormentors pulled off his pants and with their fingernails began to try to carry out their threat while they laughed. Now, my friend is now well over 60, pretty strong, but he cried at that memory. A lot of people have had memories triggered by the national debate of the past couple weeks. Brett Kavanaugh strongly denies that he assaulted Blasey Ford, and many of his supporters are saying while they don't think he did it, they believe someone else might have attacked Ford. They believe that. And others do as well. As you've no doubt heard, hotlines are ringing off the hook with people identifying. The National Sexual Assault Hotline reported its busiest day in history last Friday, the day after the Judiciary Committee hearings, with more than 3,000 calls, a 738% increase. On a micro level, at Chicago's Rape Crisis Hotline, calls tripled. Ann Pizzillo heads the clinical program at the YWCA of Metropolitan Chicago. They run the city's hotline and all 3 of the city's rape crisis centers. She joins us from Chicago. Ann, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And what has it been like? Try to describe what the phones there have been like.
It's been very busy. So the day of the hearing, we received about 30 calls, which is nearly doubled from the week prior, and 5 times as many calls as 2 weeks ago Thursday. On Friday, our calls were a little more than doubled from the week prior, and we're continuing to see an increased call volume.
Right. What are people saying?
We're hearing comments from survivors that, similar to Dr. Ford, they're experiencing a re-traumatization. We had a caller tell us that they had their first flashback in 3 years after listening to Dr. Ford's testimony. We're hearing from male survivors that the testimony validated their experience and they're still dealing with the impact. We had another male caller tell us that he's experiencing intimacy issues as a result of childhood sexual assault. So the symptoms and stress reactions of the trauma are still with folks, even decades later.
When you say somebody had a flashback, you know, somebody might who hasn't had a physical flashback might think, oh, so they had a memory. But you're talking about more than that.
Yeah, absolutely. So a flashback is for a survivor a re-experiencing of that traumatic event. They feel as if they are right back in that moment. They feel their heart pounding. They feel their thoughts race. They feel intense feelings of anxiety. And it's like experiencing the trauma all over again. And it's unexpected. Mm-hmm. And a survivor can't necessarily tell what, where, when, and how a flashback might be triggered.
Yeah, my friend talked about the laughter, that suddenly this sort of demonic laughter floated back from his past. He also talked about being pinned down. And I had another friend tell me, just imagine, regardless of who it might have been, somebody larger than 15-year-old girl, with all his weight leaning on her, putting his hand over her face, more than likely covered both her mouth and her nose. And this friend had me do that. And I ask anyone, you know, who can now do this. And you can't breathe. Blasey Ford said she thought she was going to accidentally be killed. You know, in other words, this isn't about sex. Do people, when they come for help or when they call for help, do they talk about that aspect of it?
Absolutely. They're talking about all the details of their trauma. They're talking about the feeling of being choked, of being immobilized, of being frozen. We know that when we experience trauma, our brain is going to react typically in one of three ways. We're going to fight, we're going to experience fright, or we're going to flee. And what Blasey Ford is reporting in her testimony is that there was an aspect of being frozen, as well as that intense feeling of fear. Mm-hmm. And we're hearing that as well from the survivors that we work with.
When you say people have flashbacks, you've also explained to us that people called to say that they thought they were seeing Dr. Ford, you know, a college professor, re-presencing to when she was 15, and they did the same thing. What does that mean?
That means that their body and brain, their neurobiology, literally takes them back to that moment. And we know as we talk to survivors about their trauma narrative, they are able to define frequently what the worst part of that experience was. And so it might be the worst part related to the disclosure. It might be the worst part related to the response of the alleged offender. But we know that survivors have the capacity, because of the way that trauma is stored in the brain, to literally represence themselves and re-experience that trauma in an incredibly intense way.
Well, some of us thought that she actually sounded 15 at times. And I don't know if that's what you meant, that she was actually going back to that moment.
That was certainly my sense of her when she was testifying. I wouldn't be able to speak to what that was exactly like for her. But yes.
Yeah. Look, the majority leader of the New Jersey State House, an 83-year-old, Loretta Weinberg, after watching the hearings, revealed that she'd been groped and forcibly kissed by a man when she was 13. Shireen Ghorbani, a Utah congressional candidate, went public with her sexual attack when she was 8 years old. Patty Davis, President Reagan's daughter, revealed that she'd been raped by a music executive. Chris Wallace, the Fox News anchor, went on the air to talk about how his two daughters confronted him to tell him that there were things happening in their high school that he didn't know, you know, was happening to his daughters, maybe not the full attacks that we've been hearing about, but something very troubling to him. So this has started this national conversation. But on the other hand, Brett Kavanaugh is strongly denying that this happened. Christine Blasey Ford is not believed by a lot of people, including, it seems, President Trump, who initially said he found her credible. But last night, as you well know, in a rally, mocked her. Let's listen to a little of that.
How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. What neighborhood was it in? I don't know. Where's the house? I don't know.
Ann Pizzillo again from the Chicago Rape Crisis Centers. What happens when you have this huge national dialogue and people are feeling safe to come out and tell their stories, and then suddenly there is a pivot? Now we are hearing the president and his son say it's a dangerous time for men who are being falsely accused.
We're hearing from callers that they're feeling dismayed, that there will never be enough details to convince some people that a crime was committed. They're feeling invalidated by the national conversation, by the victim blaming. And they know that they will not be able to recall 100% of the details. And this fact about traumatic stress reactions, the way the brain and the body processes trauma, is being used against survivors to invalidate their experience.
Because as Dr. Ford said, and as so many others have said, and anybody who's had a traumatic experience of any kind knows, you're taken out of yourself. You do forget some of the details. I mean, that's not uncommon.
Correct. And that's the way that the brain and body works to protect survivors. And it's a part of trauma. And so to expect a survivor to recall the exact details of a sexual assault, whether that assault was 5 days ago, 5 weeks, 5 months, 5 years, or 15 years, really belies the incredible complexity of the way that the brain operates and honestly contributes to victim blaming and myth-making around sexual assault and sexual violence.
And we should say that Christine Blasey Ford did describe some of the things the president said that she didn't. But at any rate, others have said it's like trying to describe a nightmare. So we await the FBI's investigation and the Senate's decision tomorrow. What are you bracing for?
We're bracing for increased calls to our hotline. We're bracing for increased requests for counseling. We're bracing for our current clients experiencing triggers. And I think survivors find themselves, you know, in this incredibly powerful moment, caught between pressure to come forward and a feeling that their experience will be invalidated. I think this is an incredibly critical moment for our country, for our government, for survivors of sexual violence across the country.
It's Ann Pizzillo. She heads the clinical program at the YWCA of Metropolitan Chicago. They run the hotlines in all three rape crisis centers there. Ann, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And, of course, we know that people have been falsely accused of sexual assault, no doubt. But there is a huge number of people who have been assaulted. And we're just wondering, what has your experience been this past couple of weeks? Is this familiar to you?
About 40,000 people hike the Grand Canyon each year, and after trekking for as long as 5 hours to the bottom, most people are ready for a big meal and a long, deep sleep if they can get it. But for an elite few, this is just a warm-up. Increasingly, the canyon is becoming a destination for trail runners wanting to push their limits. From KJZZ's Stina Sieg reports on what it means to run from one rim to the other and back again.
Cool your heels at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and you'll spot them. Tiny packs on their backs, water bottles strapped to their chests, focused looks on their faces. The rim-to-rim-to-rim uniform. Jocelyn Briggs ran down the South Rim early this morning, then ran across the canyon floor, up the North Rim, then back down. It's been
tough. Really tough. Yeah, that was a tough climb. Yeah, it beat us up pretty bad.
When Briggs reaches the top of the canyon again in a few hours, she'll have tackled almost two marathons worth of steep, rugged trail. And why?
That's a good question. A friend of mine wanted to do it, and I said that I would do it with her.
Since it doesn't require a permit, there's no official data on how many people take this challenge, which ranges between 42 and 48 miles, depending on which trails you choose. But what's clear is that its popularity has exploded in the past 5 or so years, with countless articles and Facebook groups highlighting its beauty and pain. In 2014, it hooked now famed trail runner Kat Bradley.
It's so humbling. You know, the canyon never ends. And so you have no choice but to feel small.
The route was 25 miles longer than Bradley had ever run. But still, she beat her buddies up the trail.
I just had this totally new understanding what my body was capable of.
That jump-started Bradley's trail running hunger. In 2017, she won the Western States 100-mile endurance run. A few months later, on her 8th rim-to-rim-to-rim run, she smashed the women's record by more than 20 minutes. But Bradley says her favorite canyon memory was actually a few years before, when her headlamp went out somewhere between the two rims, and she had to navigate the empty trail by the full moon.
I just felt so connected and to where I was, and I felt so lucky to be experiencing that moment, you know, completely alone in this, like, vast place.
That sweet solitude draws athletes from all over the world. And some of them inevitably wear headphones, talk loudly in the wee morning hours, and aren't courteous to hikers and mules. Canyon rangers say that since the running boom began, bathrooms have gotten more crowded and more litter has appeared along the trail. Rescues have increased, too, with one ranger saying these runners sometimes don't understand the vital importance of eating salty snacks to replace all that sodium they're sweating out. For many who love this place, making room for the runners is a big shift.
I've never ran through a museum, so I've never come and say, oh, I got through the Smithsonian in 2 hours.
Brian Couch is tending the Phantom Ranch canteen at the bottom of the canyon. He's hiked the backcountry here for decades, always savoring it.
I think it should be experienced, felt. You know, this go rim to rim one day, I don't think you get the experience.
At a spigot just outside, runners have been filling up their bottles all day. One of them is Toby Essler, who hit the trail at 4 a.m. and says he's watched all kinds of people challenging themselves today. Fellow runners and hikers, ranging from very young to very old.
You know, I can see people doing things that 20, 40, 50 years ago, it just wouldn't have happened.
And Essler thinks that desire to push past old boundaries creates such a sense of possibility.
When I go back into the real world and I get despondent and hopeless, I think about the people who are out here doing this stuff. And I think, yeah, the world does change. It takes time, but it happens. And that's inspiring.
Essler's still a few hours of intense climbing from that real world now, with beer, pizza, and family waiting at the top. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg, reporting from the Grand Canyon.
I'll tell you what, walking that trail is enough for me.
Yes.
A brief update now from Indonesia, where we're closely following the recovery efforts after Friday's earthquake and tsunami. The island of Sulawesi was the hardest hit, and according to the government, the death toll has risen to more than 1,400. Much of the attention has been focused on the city of Palu, where most of the confirmed dead have been counted. But the United Nations is warning that humanitarian teams still haven't reached some of the worst affected areas on the island, and it's much more difficult to get food and medicine there. Meanwhile, there's also been a volcano eruption on the same island, hundreds of miles away from Palu. Officials say it is not a threat to the relief effort. More to come on that story as it develops. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.